thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Got one.
Here's John Williams.
Well, it's actually a question. You'll get a chance to answer it. It's 109. I want you to text the answer to the following question. What should the Cubs do? What should the Cubs do? I'm thinking big thoughts. I don't have the answer to that, but boy, that'd be pretty good if you had the answer to that question today. Kim just reminded you that the Cubs play today. They're back at home. If we have any hope of getting to the World Series, we have to win tonight's game. If we don't win tonight's game, it means we have to win the next four in a row against a team we can't even seem to play with. And two of those games would be on the road. We have to win tonight's game to have a chance. So text to 312-981-7200 what you think the Cubs should do to stay competitive, to win, and get into the next to this World Series. David Hahn, the Chicago Tribune today, who's always good, on the front page of the Tribune today, said, okay, let's break it down. Jason Hayward has no RBI in the postseason. Javi Baez is hitless in 19 playoff appearances, and his word, he's been clueless at the plate. Ben Zobrist hasn't been performing like Ben Zobrist. Chris Bryant's hitting 179 in the playoffs. Wilson Contreras is hitting 182 in the playoffs. Anthony Rizzo is hitting 154 in the playoffs. Haw's idea is to move Russell and Rizzo around. Maybe have Rizzo hit in the leadoff position. That seemed to work well for everybody earlier in the season. Russell seems to have a clue at the plate. Let him hit cleanup for a change. He noticed that the Cubs have in 210 playoff appearances at the plate. Playoff appearances at the plate this year, we have struck out 73 times out of 210 plate appearances. And his suggestion, so if he were to text, I think he would say the following. I mean, it's enough to point out some of that, some of it obvious, some of it less so, but what are you going to do about it, right? He said, start Ian Happ, who's only had four at-bats in the postseason. Tommy La Stella has a good eye and has hit good pitching well in his career. Alex Avila seemed to be able to do well. Could he do any worse than hitting well below 200? He said, you've got to mix things up right now. We're playing so goofy, you got to try some goofy stuff. Couldn't agree with him more. If you have any specific suggestions or general philosophical ideas, text them to 312-981-7200. We will share them. So far, the following texts have poured in. The Cubs should get some hits.
Tom. John?
The Cubs should hit the ball. Here's another text. The Cubs should score some runs. These are all fine.
If you have an impact player.
Oh, Lord. So listen to this. Hi, Steve Bertrand.
Hi, John.
In the WGN radio newsroom. Steve's go ahead and tell the whole story. Don't just start at the middle.
The great Wayne Larrivee taught me many years ago that
when Steve starts a story like that in the newsroom, everybody opens up their phones and starts just like looking really
right.
Busy.
Solitaire. When we were doing the Bears games, you know, he was the play-by-play, I was the producer, and it was a Bears-Packer game at Soldiers Field.
Yeah.
There, I said that. And Reggie White had been quiet the whole game. And then late in the fourth quarter, when the moment came, Reggie White had a key tackle, turned the game around, the Packers won.
Right.
And Larrivee said then, and really I've always thought of it, because that is the mark of a great impact player. They might be quiet when you think you need them, but then all of a sudden when the moment comes, they rise to the moment and they make a difference.
Yeah.
So you can't make an impact if you're not on the game.
Don't change the lineup at all?
Well, I don't know about that, but I wouldn't be taking Rizzo and Bryant and all those guys out of the lineup.
From 630, the Cubs should sit Rizzo and Bryant today.
Mom, quit it.
From the 847 area code, pray, exclamation point. From 630, what should the Cubs do? They should win, for crying out loud. We're angry at our favorite team right now. I was on a radio, listen to this, I was on a sports talk show last night in Fresno.
Sorry, I heard that wrong, didn't I?
I thought, oh boy. It was a favor to a friend who does a sports talk show in Fresno. And I was happy to give him the Chicago feel. But it was just kind of funny because they aren't rooting for the Dodgers in Fresno. That's Giants territory. So they would be happy to see us win. But they're kind of mystified by what's going on here, too.
Okay, you just said something. You said we're angry at our team. You're not angry at your team, are you?
I think Cubs fans are angry right now. I said as much
really?
In Fresno, California last night. You think I am misreading the room here?
I'm not angry. I really enjoyed the night off last night.
There's A.
Because I had more fun.
Really, A and B.
I
games
mean, it,
one
it,
and two.
It is just, a, it's kind of a chore to watch the games
oh,
right
my
now.
God. And aren't you a little angry at the shoddy defense, the managerial decisions, the bad at-bats?
No, I'm not angry at all. They're better at all of that than I am. They want to win
oh,
more
boy.
Than...
Well, that's then nobody gets to drive a bus either. I mean, some people have jobs and
bus
skills.
Bus drivers.
Right, because they're skilled and trained at that, and they drive the bus. I don't know what that analogy meant. Just pretend
well,
I didn't say
let's
that.
Take some time. Go
no,
on.
No, I don't have any
it.
Time for that analogy. But it would seem to me that if you are a baseball player, then, well, it's better than I could do isn't a sufficient excuse for their poor performance.
Chris Bryant wants to hit the ball a lot more than I want him to hit the ball.
You sound like me. That's what I say when people get mad. I go, do you think when you're booing, like if a Cubs pitcher was doing bad in the middle of the season, they might get booed. And I'm like, why are you booing our pitcher? They want to do every bit as well as you want them to do, maybe even more so. So why are you booing somebody
right.
who you want to help?
So why would you be mad at them?
I'm like, nah, but that's a different thing. So I'm not going to boo them because I think that will hurt. But as it turns out, the Rizzos weren't watching the game with me. And we were very, I'd be hard-pressed to put a better word on it than agitated. Agitated? Would you give me agitated at the Cubs?
Okay, but...
I like what... put it this way, Steve. And David Haugh's not here. But if they do nothing and lose, won't we be equally dismayed at the sort of, lack of creative thinking on Joe Maddon's part? Don't you want him to try something? I mean, it's not game one. This will be our, let's see... 5, 6, 7. This will be our 8th playoff game.
So you would say if they lose tonight, it's like, well, they lost, but it took guts to bat Tommy La Stella cleanup. Good for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Whatever. Or put Addison Russell there and let La Stella hit 7. I don't know where you're going to put him, but La Stella, to me, is a pretty disciplined hitter.
I like La Stella. I'm just saying.
I would, well, so if he had La Stella or Happ in the starting lineup tonight, La Stella may be a stretch, but Ian Happ's had a lot.
I could
of,
see Happ, sure.
Sure. Avila hit a catching. Good.
No.
Let's give Contreras a break.
No. Yeah. No way. It's game three of the NLCS. You're going to take maybe your best player for the season out of the game?
Your best players
who
are
better?
Hitting 182, 154, 179.
Nowhere to go but up, my friend.
Okay. More texts have poured in. Bryant needs to get his eyes checked. What should the Cubs do? Drink hot cocoa, eat s'mores, and then go beat the crap out of the Dodgers. Dye coach's hair back to white. John, you have to swing the bat to hit the ball. From the 219 area code, the Cubs should call a priest. Yell at Baez to be serious at the plate. The Cubs should put Ian Happ in the game. The Cubs should be happy they won last year. The Cubs were the best team in baseball last year. And the last 2.5, 3 weeks of this season, they were the best team in baseball. Cubs fans better realize that they're not going to beat L.A. They haven't got a prayer. Dodgers in 5. Asked in a radio talk show on a sports station in Fresno last night what I thought was going to happen. I said, I think it's the Dodgers in 6. I hate that, but I just don't see us winning 4 of the next 5. So I have the Dodgers winning now.
Well, if we're going to lose.
Pains me to say that.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll keep reading your texts. Keep them coming. It's hard to keep track of all of the tragedies in the news these days. Incidentally, we will be talking with Pamela Banos. Her book is about Vivian Maier at 135. Vivian Maier, the famed Chicago nanny photographer. Again, not a perfect description ever. We'll talk about that. In the 2 o'clock hour, we visit with an astrophysicist about those two colliding neutron stars. Here's my favorite factoid about the two colliding neutron stars 130 million years ago. That if you took the stuff of one of those stars before they collided, a teaspoon of it would weigh 1 billion tons. A teaspoon of it Okay, think of a teaspoon. That would weigh a billion tons. I could spend all day on that. You could just sit there in reverie on the L and just go, man, that would really be heavy. So anyway, those stars collided, and the next thing you know, we have ripples in the space-time fabric. I don't even know what I just said. Well, it's fascinating stuff, and isn't it nice to know that we have people who do? And that'll be after 2 o'clock. We'll also play for you some of Donald Trump's most irrelevant things that he's said in the last 48 hours. And Steve, I'm sort of coming to that conclusion. I know that we shouldn't forget that this man is the kind of person that he is. But I think all Donald Trump has done in the last day and a half is remind us of who he is. And it's a sort of piling on that I think has diminishing returns in terms of its value to us. You do not know anything about Donald Trump today that you didn't a week ago. So if John McCain or Barack Obama or Gold Star families or other presidents, he makes it sound like there's been thousands and thousands of presidents. There have been 45. And if you say, since the evolution of the telephone, there have been even fewer. The idea that some of the presidents didn't call makes it sound like there's hundreds and hundreds who never called. There's a handful of them. And we don't know of one who did not appropriately reach out to the fallen families.
So you're saying if you just stop pointing that out?
I think you can. I think the news can do it. You and I are going to talk about it, trust me. But I think that there's nothing to gain except you get to hate him some more or you can defend him even less.
Well, and there definitely, how does that help? There definitely is piling on and there's, you know, people going overboard. I agree with that. But if you allow statements like he made yesterday to go unchecked, then they start to become a little bit more true, or he starts to become a little bit more truthful. And that doesn't serve us.
We'll play the audio. We'll play the John McCain audio, too. And for that matter, what Trump has said about what John McCain said about what Trump said. And I'm not checking out of the school that you're describing there, Steve. We need to remind ourselves that this is the world we live in. But it's not fake news, it's distracting news. That's my new mantra. We need to be careful of distracting news, not fake news. I'll do this. We'll pause for a second, and I want to read to you a short note that I got from Beth Swerk, my old producer, who you mentioned earlier, right? Beth Swerk, the producer who used to work with us here and now lives in San Francisco, not too far, of course, from the wine country. And she sent me a picture and a comment that positively gave me goosebumps. And it will you too. So Beth Swerk, our longtime producer here, now works out in wine country. She's in the marketing and advertising business. We stay in touch with her. She was on with us the other day describing the devastation. She was in tears because it wasn't just a devastating story, but it was very personal for her. Beth has friends who live closer to the fire. Some of them have lost their homes. Some of them have lost their vineyards. And so she sent me a picture a couple of days ago. And it says, a friend of mine has been evacuated from her house. She went back today and found this on her doorstep. So they've evacuated. The fire has swept through. The people come back to their homes or what's left of their homes. And there on the doorstep of this friend of Beth's home is a burnt, somewhat crumpled up piece of paper. It's charred on the outside. You can only read a little bit of it. And the part that you can read, you can see, is from the Bible. It's a page of the Bible. And the burnt page there reads, "And they shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat the fruit of them." And a crumpled page with only that revealed from the Bible is on the step of a friend who's experienced the fire coming through her neighborhood. There's the Bible. "And they shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat the fruit of them." I don't know what you do with that. But it wasn't the lady's Bible. And I suppose somewhere a Bible burned. And I'm supposed somewhere the pages became free and they flew in the wind and they had to land somewhere. I guess you could find a way to explain it. But if you want to say, wow, that's majestic or creepy, you get to have that with one like that. Thank you for sharing that, Beth. Okay, so Elif, that was quicker than I thought.
Thanks. See, you know how I can do that really fast.
Steve, you know how I like to yell at Elif to come up with crazy things like, Elif,
right,
give me Frank Thomas's career pitches seen per plate appearance, which we still haven't found, by the way. I found everything about Frank Thomas. I can tell you the scores he got on tests in grade school. I cannot find Frank Thomas's career pitches per plate appearance. We wanted to talk about that the other day.
Pitches per at bat.
Pitches per at bat, which I think is the same as plate appearance. I think they call it plate appearance, PA, in the statistic books. Anyway. So here's the next crazy witch hunt I sent Elif on. I said, Elif, find out how long the president of the United States has had access to the telephone, and then how many presidents have been in office since then, to see how many people have, in fact, haven't even had the opportunity to call the loved ones of people who have died in service to this country. For some, because the president makes it sound like there are a lot of them who haven't done this, reached out to the families. First of all, there aren't that many of them, period. So which one specifically? Was it Benjamin Harrison that you're mad at? Who exactly? Because Obama made the calls. The Bushes both made the calls. And at least one of the Bushes served in World War II as a bomber pilot. So let's not argue with his, you know, bona fides. I'll bet you Ronald Reagan did. I'll bet you Bill Clinton. I mean, just let's just back it up and land on the president that ignored the opportunity and responsibility to reach out to the fallen people's loved ones. Who exactly are you talking about? Or are you just throwing stuff against the wall here? Are you just throwing hate randomly against the wall? I don't even know why I asked Elif to do this, but I do have it in case you need it. It's 1:29. We'll get into some of the president's latest misgivings after 2. The latest book about Vivian Maier is thoughtful and beautiful, and it's a Chicago story. I think anybody who has heard the story of Vivian Maier is instantly attracted to it. The photographer who was a nanny who spent many of her years in Chicago, also in New York and France. But she is that woman who sort of silently moved through our city, capturing some images that are spectacular. There are moments in Vivian Maier photography that you think, how did she even come upon that? If she was so fortunate to see that person or that moment, that would be a great story. But she seemed to have a lot of them. And then she seemed to capture them. And then she seemed to capture them perfectly. Sometimes her photos were posed or staged. That happened often enough. But either way, this was a gifted woman. And you never knew about her until the photos became available at a public auction 10 years ago today. Some of her stuff was literally sold off for a couple $100. And that's not necessarily where the story begins, but it's where our fascination begins. In our studio is Pamela Banos, who has written Vivian Maier, A Photographer's Life and Afterlife. What a good subtitle. Pamela, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much for having me.
So where do we start?
Well, we could start wherever you like. It's the life and the afterlife. So I'm telling two stories with a thread, which is the history of photography, to sort of contextualize her work and even the context of what's happened with her work.
That's an apt description, though, at least at the beginning, right? There she was taking these pictures anonymously to the general public and stored them in 5 lockers, right? 5 lockers?
5, and there were more as well after her death that emerged.
Why didn't she display them? Why wasn't she in magazines? Why wasn't she known at the time?
Well, those are hard questions. I think she chose to not be known, especially at the end, when she was living amongst people who knew she was carrying a camera but didn't know what her pictures were of, and she chose to not share them. It's hard to know when I think at her creative peak, which was in the 50s, when she was on the streets in New York and doing the kinds of things that then her work became compared to other photographers. It was a different climate for sharing work and showing work and selling work at that time.
There wasn't the internet either. I mean, imagine what she could have done if she could have edited on her own and displayed on her own. I wonder if she would have had a website and just carefully put stuff out there. Maybe not. Maybe not even then.
Well, what I saw was that she took so many pictures that she just, and it accelerated as she went on, that at a certain point it seemed like just indiscriminate photography, and she took photographs with two and three cameras simultaneously in motion pictures. And at a certain point, she just stopped developing her film as well.
So are you diminishing her talent then?
Not at all. Not at all. I think she was completely individualistic. I think she started at a time when camera culture was booming in the 50s in ways that I don't think we appreciate today because we don't even use cameras anymore so much.
What was her talent?
Her talent was the rapport she had with people on the street, of being invisible on the street, of seeing things and catching them and recording them, that I think was for herself.
A lot of the photos I mentioned a moment ago seemed posed, right? She would get the people to... She wasn't just sneaking up on them. She would say, all right, you kids all stand in a row this way.
Well, that was one way that she did it. And that's part of what I'm trying to do in the book is to characterize her correctly, which is that she was all of that and more. She started with posing people. She started doing landscape photography. And then she became known for her on-the-street photography of people who were unaware.
But if she took a picture of someone who was unaware, sometimes you would think after she took the picture, they must have become aware. And then I wonder what the ethic is in that moment. Do you have to ask permission to take a picture or to have a picture or to later publish a picture of that person?
On the street, it's more open. And actually, in the photos that are in my book, there's a two-picture sequence where she's taking a photograph of somebody not far from where we're sitting right now, actually, by the river on Wacker.
Yeah.
And the first shot shows him sort of realizing she just took his picture.
Oh, the guy that's got the suit on, yeah, buttoned up. He looks like either a well-dressed homeless person or something in between.
Dirty white suit. Yeah. And in the second frame, they have an agreeable rapport.
Right. So you got the feeling that he said, okay, now you can take my picture.
Or that
he was smiling for it.
Yeah, or that they had some kind of conversation.
And she seems to be such a recluse. It's hard to imagine that she would be able to engage people that way.
Well, but that's because that's our common perception of her. And that's also something that I like to talk about because I think that she's been represented by people who didn't know her. She's being represented by people who she chose to not share of herself, and therefore she becomes a mystery.
Whose existence she didn't even know of. I mean, let's go to the lockers then. So she's storing this stuff away. When the stuff became available for sale, that is, you know what happens with storage lockers, they auction the stuff off, and hers was the object of one of those auctions. Was she alive at that time?
Yes, for another year and a half, actually.
Why did she choose to let her life's work lapse like that? Did she know it was auctioned off?
That's so hard to know. I actually posit a number of questions when I start talking about it. I learned that storage facility had just changed hands. It had just changed names. They had just done a multi-million dollar renovation. It's possible that she received mail from some new storage locker company that she didn't recognize.
Those companies are not very patient, though, right? I mean, if you're...
Sixty-nine days.
Right. It's 70 days. On the 70th day, you lose it. And I thought your timeline was even swifter than that. But okay, a couple months go by, and now they can sell her stuff, and they do. We don't know if she ever knew that, right?
Correct, right.
Amazing. So then this guy John Maloof, mm-hmm, buys it from the guy that originally got it, right?
Well, he's one of many buyers.
Yeah.
And he's the one that we've learned about her through because he eventually accumulated work from some of the original buyers.
And has the rights to a lot of that work, right?
No, he does not.
He does not? Who has the rights to her work?
The Cook County Probate Court.
That's right. Are you mad at the people that took her stuff, bought her stuff, began reproducing her stuff?
No, I'm not mad at anybody. I mean, I think that her work has become a celebration. There's ethical questions that do get raised because of the way that she did not share her work. But because of what we've seen, and because of how she's being celebrated, I think that it's good. I actually have an ethical dilemma about this because I've never truly felt that we deserve to see these pictures because of the way that she chose not to share them.
That's why I asked the question. I mean, doesn't it seem to be a violation of this extraordinarily private person?
Yeah. And so
and they're profiting on it, too, I might add. Or trying to.
Or did until the court. What I figured is the cat's now out of the bag. Like, the story has opened, and what I'm trying to do is tell it as accurately as possible. So I'm trying to tell her story with her being a photographer first and a nanny as her chosen occupation so she could support her photography habit, and then to say as carefully as possible how this happened, how she came to be.
You make that distinction. She's not the nanny who had a hobby of photography She was the photographer who supported her occupation with being a nanny.
Right.
She was a photographer first.
I believe so, yeah.
That's a nice distinction, and I think the work bears that out. It's 146. Somebody just texted in and said, how could she be such an indiscriminate photographer? I presume they mean invisible to a lot of the subjects, since she was so tall. And she would always take pictures of herself. I didn't know this until your book, but you'd show plenty of instances and talk about how she would never pass by a mirror, that she wouldn't take a picture of the mirror or the objects around it and catch herself in the reflection.
Well, this text that just came in, I think, might have been referring to me saying that she was photographing indiscriminately in her later practice. And when you see all of her negatives, not just the ones that have been selected to sell books and to sell prints and that have been edited for her, so we can't forget that the people who acquired her work are the ones that got to define her. And when you look at all of her negatives, she used her camera like a copy machine by the time. I mean, she photographed documents. She archived her life the way we now use our digital.
She would take pictures of newspapers.
Everything. Her bank book, her correspondence, everything.
Really?
Yeah.
Imagine what she would have done in the digital era. Or maybe it's best she was...
Well, I think she's a prototype for the way we use our phones now, actually.
It's 146. This is WGN. The book is Vivian Meyer, A Photographer's Life and Afterlife by Pamela Banos. Today is the 10-year anniversary of one of the major auctions of her items that sort of got at least part of the story here going. We're talking about, here it is, I want to make sure I have the book in my hand, Vivian Meyer, A Photographer's Life and Afterlife by Pamela Banos. The book is out now, it's in bookstores everywhere, and we're talking about Vivian Meyer, who I've been giving Chicago credit for. Is she the Chicago photographer? Is she the Manhattan photographer? The New York photographer?
Yeah, she's the photographer of the world. She's the international photographer.
Is she known around the world now?
Oh, yeah. I was in China giving a Vivian Meyer talk a couple years ago. There was a 2-day symposium where Chinese scholars presented papers on Vivian Meyer.
What are they saying? How is the world seeing her?
I didn't
work?
Have very good translations.
Isn't that funny? But there's obviously an interest in what she was able to
do.
And so let's just back up a moment. We were telling the story about the discovery of her stuff in these lockers. These guys, how did they realize what they had? You know what I mean?
It happened over the course of time. In fact, well, John Maloof started selling her negatives on eBay, and people started recognizing these images, and he sold about 200 of her.
Recognizing, meaning recognizing
that they were special.
Art, the value.
So people were buying individual frames as he was developing some of her undeveloped film that he had acquired. And he did that for a few months and then stopped because people were basically, one person actually said, you need to stop dispersing the archive.
Why?
Because if she was special, we should keep it together. So when I started talking about Vivian Meyer, I was giving talks that were called Vivian Meyer's Fractured Archive, because her work dispersed almost immediately.
Is that unfortunate?
I think so, if you're trying to really understand who she is.
Because, it's better to have it all in one place, or a timeline.
Or to have it aggregated somewhere in one place, because there's still several collectors.
But who has the rights to the photography? You mentioned Cook County's role in this, but it's not these guys that bought the stuff or, quote-unquote, had the rights. It would be her heirs. But she was never married, never had any children, right?
Right.
So does she have siblings or heirs that would be in line to her work?
The next in line would have been her brother, who died in 1977, and she was the last surviving member of her immediate family for 30 years by the time she died.
But didn't she have family in France?
She did, but they're distant relatives.
And they don't know her.
Right. And that's called the laughing heir.
Why is that?
Because they don't know. And first, so the reason her copyright was challenged by somebody who didn't know who she was, who came forward as the heir who should be,
That doesn't make their claim illegitimate. It makes it fortunate.
Yes, but the laughing heir, because, they're claiming something from someone that they didn't know personally.
Sure. But you know how I feel about that? I mean, when Prince died, there became a bunch of heirs and faux heirs, and some of them were close to him and some of them were not. And you think, how is it that because this man was a genius and made a fortune, you suddenly get to benefit from that windfall? But I guess that's the way it goes. That's so there's somebody in France who deserves this much more than John Maloof does, right?
Yeah, I don't know about deserve. Right now, we have the Illinois State's attorney, who is the representative of unknown heirs. That's the job of the Illinois State's attorney.
And they're ultimately going to decide who has the rights to this?
They have the rights. So there's a supervised public administrator.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. But ultimately, won't this pass to an individual?
Not if that can't be proven.
Really? Then what would the result of the use of or display of the photos be then?
It's being administered by the estate. The estate is collecting monies from the sale of her work now.
Okay.
Royalties.
And where does that money go?
It goes into the estate.
And then what happens to that?
I think in 7 years it becomes part of the Cook County Treasury.
Okay, but that's what I thought. So I'm not crazy about Cook County profiting from this either, right? I mean, that's kind of weird. Cook County, boy, that's a nameless, faceless, poor representative of people's wealth, but... maybe they will ultimately, and maybe that's a good thing, right? I mean, at least then it's the public has easier access to her stuff. No,
because there's still the material is in the hands of the people who acquired it, but the intellectual property belongs to Cook County. So there needs to be a collaboration between the two of them for any reproduction, licensing, and things like that.
Are you giving any more talks about this?
Yeah, I've got something scheduled at the University Club next month. I was just invited to New York to another club to give a talk. It's exciting times for me now after 5 years of trying to put this story together.
It's more than just the story of Vivian Meyer and the discovery. It's Vivian Meyer, the person. And we shouldn't forget that that photographer and those photographs represent a real live human being. And you'll learn a lot about the art of photography and the schools of photographic thought from Vivian Meyer, A Photographer's Life and Afterlife by Pamela Banos. Yeah, really well done. I appreciate you coming into our studio.
Thank you for having me.
What a pleasure. If you are interested in this story, you need this one.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
Here we go. All the way until 3 o'clock. Yep, it's a two-hour show. I don't know how he does it either. This is John Williams. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. And boy, what a pretty view we have of nice people walking by and waving to us. Blue skies and... the great architecture of downtown Chicago. This is the place to be. And I just want to say one other thing about the book and the author that was just in our studio. Pamela Banos was here. She's from Northwestern. She wrote a book about Vivian Meyer. It's subtitled A Photographer's Life and Afterlife, because what's happened in a way is just as fascinating after she's passed away, the discovery of her photographs, the fact that the rights to them have fallen to the hands of Cook County and may be there in perpetuity. On the cover of her book are three pictures from Vivian Meyer. And the one in the top left-hand corner of the cover of her book shows three people. And it's kind of an odd photo because you're looking sort of in through the windows of a cab. So there's odd reflections and images, and it's hard to tell exactly what you're looking at with the glass and the shine, but you see three faces. The faces are Cary Grant, James Mason, and Eva Marie Saint, and that was them in a taxi cab in 1958 when they were filming Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest. That picture. So here is our guest sitting here, Pamela Banos, and we were talking about the images in the book and on the cover, and then she goes, "Oh my God, that's right. Where we are right now, literally as we sit here, is where that picture was taken from." And I don't know if she meant literally inside this spot or literally on the sidewalk 10 feet in front of me, probably that. But it was right here on Michigan Avenue, where the Tribune Tower was, that the cab was, that Vivian Meyer stood and took that famous photograph that's on the cover of her book and then in a plate also inside the book itself. She, "Hokey smokes," she said, or words to that effect. I asked you to text to us. What should the Cubs do? My number's 312-981-7200. Text to 312-981-7200. We mentioned David Haugh's very good front page piece in the Chicago Tribune today about the Cubs and how bad they are, and then some specific suggestions that Haugh had, like put Rizzo and Bryant on the bench. Steve Bertrand did not know that that was a good idea. I'm not sure that that would pay dividends, but I want him to try something. Steve likes the tried and true strikeout, strikeout, strikeout.
It can't last forever.
So Steve wants to ride it out, and others of us are getting itchy. Here's what the texter said. Hey, John, the Cubs should land some strikes in the Dodgers' balls. I guess that's a pun. John, the Cubs should sacrifice a chicken to Jobu. John, it's simple. The Cubs should get to Wrigley and discover buckets of water balloons waiting for them. They should go out and have a bunch of fun throwing them at each other. And then they should put hot pepper juice on Puig's bat. Go Cubs. John, the Cubs should trust Joe. John, the Cubs should get more hits. John, the Cubs should get more base runners. Madden should make all of the players dress like clowns when they arrive at that game. If that happens, I guarantee a win. Well, evidently, you don't have any good ideas either. So we'll see how it goes. You can text your ideas to 312-981-7200. All right, let's just walk through this. So this is Donald Trump at a sort of a ad hoc press conference the other day. He was asked about what was his response to the soldiers who were lost in that raid in Niger. This is Trump Cut One.
How have we heard anything from you so far about the soldiers that were killed in Niger, and what do you have to say about
them? I've written them personal letters. They've been sent, or they're going out tonight, but they were written during the weekend. I will, at some point during the period of time, call the parents and the families, because I have done that traditionally. I felt very, very badly about that. I always feel badly. It's the toughest calls I have to make. Now it gets to a point where, you know, you make four or five of them in one day. It's a very, very tough day. For me, that's by far the toughest. So the traditional way, if you look at President Obama and other presidents, most of them didn't make calls. A lot of them didn't make calls. I like to call when it's appropriate, when I think I'm able to do it. I actually wrote letters individually to the soldiers we're talking about, and they're going to be going out either today or tomorrow.
So that's President Trump. Again, one and a half now, Elif, if this is what the president said.
The traditional way, if you look at President Obama and other presidents, most of them didn't make calls. A lot of them didn't make calls.
Okay. So that's what he said. Then this was a follow-up question later in that press conference.
Earlier you said that President Obama never called the families of fallen soldiers. How can you make that claim?
I don't know if he did. No. I was told that he didn't often, and a lot of presidents don't. They write letters. I do. Excuse me, Peter. I do a combination of both. President Obama, I think, probably did sometimes, and maybe sometimes he didn't. I don't know. That's what I was told. Other presidents did not call. They'd write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Okay, so who are the presidents that didn't do anything? I'd like to know who they are. Nah, I don't care, because it's not important. None of this really is. Here's one takeaway for me, though. This is a president who does realize that he is going to be fact-checked on this. You thought that Donald Trump was impervious to that, and don't worry, I'll play for you a clip in a moment where he calls CNN's broadcast of this fake news, even though they were his words. But listen to him sort of back out of what he just said. Two and a half.
President Obama, I think, probably did sometimes, and maybe sometimes he didn't. I don't know. That's what I was told.
I think maybe sometimes he did, maybe he didn't. I don't know. That's what I was told. I think maybe sometimes he did, maybe he didn't. I don't know. That's what I was told. So if those are the legs you're going to stand on, what you're saying must be really important to you. And what's really important to him is for you to know that it causes him great pain to make these phone calls, and that he makes calls and writes letters. And that's all he knows. So he's not only turning this around and making it about himself, but he doesn't even know what he's saying about President Obama. He doesn't know Obama's policy on this.
I'd love to hear a linguist, or I don't know what they're called, but look at his language and the way he says things like, well, I wrote the letters over the weekend. They're going out tonight. Or tomorrow.
Yeah.
I mean, that says, I'm going to go back and write these letters.
Oh, boy, we got to get those. And by the way, by that, I mean, somebody wrote the letter. I have to sign it.
Because if you wrote the letter, how would you know when you wrote it? When, I mean, why would it come up that when it's going to go out? right? If you send the office and you wrote a letter on Saturday, gave it to your staff, and they say, thank you, Mr. President, it's going to go out Tuesday night or Wednesday.
Well, none of this has the patina of truthiness. It sounds like a person lying. And I think that's, you know, here's my, you understood my point earlier about all of this, right, Steve? I don't think this is all that important. The president is caught being ugly and insincere, but we already know he's like that. So now we have more evidence, and it's very distracting and upsetting. But I think you can gamefully ignore this particular news arc.
See, I don't agree with that. And I know there's a danger of piling on, but not everyone agrees that he has, as you would say, truthiness issues. Some people believe that fake media are making things up.
Yeah, but
him.
I'm right. And so how does this persuade those people?
Well, I think if a leader, let's take him out of it. If a leader stands up and says something that is easily documented to be untrue, and you just stop documenting it because you've already documented so many others, then those untruths start to be accepted, and then they are normalized. And that's the danger. The risk, obviously, is to sound like you're piling on and picking and have a great bias against. But I think if some things are so, I mean, politicians always say things that could be shady or in their interest. But, you know, if someone stands up and says today is Wednesday and it's clearly Tuesday, if you start saying, well, it's going to be Wednesday, let's let it go, that hurts all of us.
All of this leads to cut three. So having been caught in this undelicate half-truth or complete falsehood, maybe the letters are going to go out, maybe he calls, maybe he writes, maybe Obama called, maybe he wrote. I don't even know what he's talking about now. I don't even know what his point is, that it's more painful to him or that he's more sincere or that he makes calls because those are more difficult than letters which Obama wrote. I mean, does anybody even know what he's trying to say, right? So he's caught dead to rights in this. So he's got now cut three, a chance to right the ship. What would you guess that this man would do? Sort of back out of it and just say, hey, listen, I'm sorry, I misspoke. Everybody does the best they can under impossible circumstances. You do what you have to do. And I don't want to take anything away from the service that other presidents perform for this country in that regard. He could have said that. Or he could have doubled down. And you know what he does. Okay, I'll let you hear that in a minute. So the president was describing how he does reach out to the families of the soldiers that were killed in Niger and that he's reached out to everybody that he can. And then just to make sure you know he's better than Obama's and Clinton's, because that's really his driving force, he said he didn't think that Obama did what he's done. When pressed upon that, cut two and a half, he says this.
President Obama, I think probably did sometimes, and maybe sometimes he didn't. I don't know. That's what I was told.
So what is he saying now? So then he's on Fox Radio, and he has a chance to clarify this. They asked him about that.
What you thought about when you brought up past presidents and what they've done. If you look at my whole, this was, again, fake news CNN. I mean, they're just a bunch of fakers. To best of my knowledge, I think I've called every family of somebody that's died. Now, as far as other representatives, I don't know. I mean, you could ask General Kelly, did he get a call from Obama? You could ask other people. I don't know what Obama's policy was. I don't know what Bush did. I don't know what Obama did. You could find out easily what President Obama did. All you have to do is ask the military people.
So he has no idea what they did, but he wants to at least cast aspersions their way that maybe they weren't as good at it as he was. And the thing he's crowing about is expressing sympathy to the people who have lost loved ones in service to this country.
So, and he hadn't, I mean, this is a minor thing, but he hadn't called all of them because the White House said he was going to call the four from Niger today. So he gave the interview before he'd called those four. No, that's a little thing. There's reporting that they went through the White House visitor records during President Obama's time, and General Kelly was there for a dinner or a reception with Gold Star families. So I don't know if he called him or sent a letter.
Well, maybe that doesn't count. Maybe that's not a private, personal call to General Kelly. Okay. See what we're doing now? Isn't this a ridiculous pursuit?
Well, if I can help make the president's case, this did come 6 months after the general's son was killed.
Okay,
but I don't know if he did other things.
Well, maybe he called. Maybe he wrote him a letter. Really, so That's what Donald Trump wants you and I to do, is start to keep score on this, to measure his empathy against Barack Obama's. What an insane calculation. What an egocentric thing for him to do. And here I'm doing his bidding. So that's been my point, Steve, that none of this matters. If you win this conversation, I could be persuaded that Donald Trump is an egocentrical child who's running this country. I already knew that. So I'm trying to make the case today that this is a distraction that we don't need. We need to figure out, I don't know, the Congress has to pass health care or taxes or I don't know what they do. Does the House of Representatives still meet? Are there any congressmen left? Because it's all Donald Trump and then a handful of senators. In fact, so there was John McCain getting something called the Liberty Award with Joe Biden at his side. And let's just get this out of the way while we're thinking about it. So here is John McCain talking about what's become of America in the last couple of years.
The fear of the world we have organized and led the three quarters of a century to abandon the ideals we have advanced around the globe, to refuse the obligations of international leadership and our duty to remain the last best hope of Earth for the sake of some half-baked, spurious nationalism cooked up by people who would rather find scapegoats than solve problems.
And then they applauded. Asked about that, Donald Trump said, "Be careful, because at some point I fight back." "Yeah, well, I hear it," he said. "And people have to be careful, because at some point I fight back. I'm being very nice. I'm being very, very nice. But at some point I fight back, and it won't be pretty." He said, "Yeah, I heard what he said." So, Mr. Trump, if you're listening and you're going to fight back, you better hurry, because that man's going to die soon, and you'd better get your licks in now. Let's talk to Ron. You're on WGN. Ron, what did you want to say?
Hi, John. Take you off speaker, please.
Thank you.
John?
Yeah.
I don't know how General Kelly can be in the White House with that man, the way he disrespected him with the comments, and his dead son who served and died in Afghanistan. But more than that, how can active duty military and just respect anything this buffoon utters or even does? You know, but what I hope is these generals are keeping a close eye on. He doesn't sneak off and start a nuclear war or some other war.
Yeah, I think we're all worried about that. I'm going to pick up another phone line. Ron, thanks for the call. I hear you, my friend. By the way, hey, John, here's a text. The first 16 or 17 presidents, I guarantee you, didn't make calls. I know. Isn't it terrible? Why aren't we saying anything about Madison or Adams? Never a call. Carol, just jump in here, and then I'll wrap this up. Carol, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, John. It's nice to talk to you. The thing that really angers me about all this that's going on is he never mentioned how sad this had to have been for the families. It was all about
it's hard for him.
Difficult, right. And that really angers me. He's so egocentric. He's so narcissistic. Does he have no sympathy for these people? And that's what's bothering me a lot.
Poor Donald Trump. Thanks for the call, Carol. It's 2:29. Your news is coming up. Time magazine has a nice piece, too. Four things to know. This is the story of the astronomers striking gold as two neutron stars collide. They've detected a collision of two neutron stars, and they say that's where the gold and platinum comes in the universe. The powerful smash-up produced gravitational waves that were picked up by observatories. It emitted a broad swath of electromagnetic radiation that could be seen by traditional telescopes. The ones that you or I could have were able to actually see some of the vestiges of this explosion or collision that took place 130 million, how many years ago? The cosmic crash described Monday occurred about 130 million light years away. I don't have the date on this, but I actually think they do. Earth's first inkling of the neutron star collision came August 17th after detectors measured a powerful gravitational chirp. The findings could explain the mysterious origins of a type of gamma ray burst known as short hard, which produces brief but highly energetic gamma ray bursts. and powerful flashes of light. What's happened here, and why is everybody so jazzed about it? Dr. Daniel Holtz is an associate professor at the Kavli Institute for Cosmological Physics at our own University of Chicago, and he joins us now on WGN. So what's, I don't know where to start with this, but I mean, what should we know about this? How it wasn't extraordinary that this happened, but that we were able to witness it, right?
Yeah, that's right. So we've thought for a long time that neutron stars every now and then should crash into each other, and that these would be spectacular explosions. But what we've done now is detected one in gravitational waves, which is an absolute first. We've detected binary black holes in the past in gravitational waves, and in fact, the Nobel Prize just a couple of weeks ago went to the first detection of gravitational waves from black holes colliding. But this, having two neutron stars collide, has never been detected before, and now we've done it. So that was a big development.
Yeah. And a neutron star is the remains of a collapsed sun that's crushed down on itself so that it's like, what, like 20 miles across or something,
right? That's right. That's right.
But it's
so
super dense.
The entire sun, and you just crush it down. So it's very, very dense.
And like a teaspoon of it weighs a billion tons or something.
That's right. That's
literally,
right.
A teaspoon of it weighs a billion tons. I mean, yeah. I could live with that for a couple of days just imagining that. What does that even mean?
Right. That's right. It's very hard. I mean, it's basically, you can think of it as a giant atomic nucleus. But
okay.
Maybe that, you know.
And so then there's one of them, and then hokey smokes. And by the way, space stuff is very dispersed. But two of these things find each other, whip around each other, and then slam into each other, right?
At close to the speed of light.
And then when they go kapow, then what happens?
Right. So first they emit all these gravitational waves, which are these ripples in space and time itself, and we detect those. But what's particularly interesting now is not only did we detect those, we also detected light. We detected gamma rays, which is, you can think of it as very blue light, so blue it's even past X-rays. It's the sort of brightest form of light. And we've detected optical light that you could see with normal telescopes, and we've even detected radio waves. We've detected the full spectrum, that light.
How long ago did these two neutron stars collide? When did this happen?
So, as you said, we think it's about 130 million years ago. And the light has been traveling to us this whole time and just arrived at our detector, swept through the Earth on August 17th.
Did we know this was coming, or was it just good fortune that we happened to be looking at the right place?
We figured that this would happen every now and then, but we certainly didn't have any advance warning that this particular one was going to happen. We were just very lucky.
So something goes beep, and a guy sitting in front of a machine goes, "Hey, what's that, Bob?" And then the next thing you know, this happened. I mean, that it just happened?
That's right. That's exactly what happened. In fact, one of the first people to get the beep was someone who works here at UChicago who said, looked at we get these pictures of what's been seen and said, "Well, that looks really interesting. Maybe we should be excited about this."
Was his name Bob?
No, Reed.
Reed
Essek.
Yeah, right. All right, so then that happens. And so then you guys say, "Wow, we think we've got one here." 130 million years ago. So what was going on Earth when that happened? Were we here?
We were not here. This is well before humans showed up.
There was Earth, right?
Yeah, but there was Earth. Earth had been around for a couple of billion years, but it was a pretty different time.
Yeah.
And one interesting thing about this is that it's taken 130 million years for the light to get to us and for the gravitational waves to get to us, but they arrived at basically the same time, within 2 seconds. Which tells us that gravitational waves travels at the speed of light, which is something we'd never been able to measure before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very exciting if you're a physicist.
I know what you're thinking. Boy, I hope John tries to explain gravity to us. Here's my understanding of gravity. You need to think of because I've always been mystified by gravity. That is, why is it the one object that doesn't have a string attached to another object? How is it the one object is able to exert an influence on another? Why are we orbiting around the sun? What is the attraction? Where's the energy or the string or the thing that keeps us pulled towards another object? And everything exerts gravitational pull on everything. You and I exert gravitational pull on each other. Say nothing of the sun and the planet. So here's the way I figured it out. That you have to think of the universe. Are you still with me?
Yes, I am. It's great.
You have to think of the universe as a trampoline. Steve, are you listening to this? Think of the universe as a trampoline. And somewhere on the trampoline, someone has set a bowling ball. Now, you and I are coming along on the trampoline. And as we get closer to the trampoline, we're going to sort of fall into a, rather than travel in a straight line, we're now going to travel in a slightly curved line because the bowling ball is pulling the fabric of the trampoline down. So now we're sort of falling into the curved arc that the bowling ball has created. You can just imagine a pea riding across that, and now it would be circling around and around because it's going down. And it is that natural inclination of things to fall into the orbit of those heavier things that is gravity. There's no magical pull. It's just the natural course of things and the fabric of space-time. Your thoughts?
That was a fantastic description. That's exactly what Einstein came up with almost exactly a century ago. You know, you would have put him out of business. That's exactly what he said, which was it's the curvature of space and time itself. And he came up with that specifically because he was uncomfortable, just as you just described, with this idea of magic strings that connect everything and pull them. Which is what, you know, what the theory said before.
So then,
the one thing I would add now is now you have to imagine if you kind of shake that bowling ball on the trampoline, what will happen is the trampoline will start to vibrate.
Right.
And those vibrations are the gravitational waves. That's what we've detected, is those vibrations in space and time shooting out from the bowling ball. In this case, the bowling ball is replaced by two ultra-dense neutron stars circling each other at the speed of light, or close to the speed of light.
So if I was going to travel to that spot then, would it take me longer because now I've got to go up and down these waves?
You know, it would take you just a little. There would be an effect, but it's minuscule. And the effect is so minuscule that it took, you know, absolutely cutting-edge technology, the best lasers we have, the shiniest mirrors, the absolute state-of-the-art, just to detect these tiny vibrations.
Isn't it amazing that we were able to pick this up? I mean, just think about the distance and the time. Go humanity. Okay, so then how is it that somehow they said, oh, that's where the platinum and the gold came from? Are you telling me that the gold that's on my ring right now was somehow created by the collision of a couple of neutron stars a zillion years ago?
Yep, that's one of the things we figured out from this. And the story goes as follows. What we've seen here, we've detected in the gravitational waves that it's two neutron stars crashing into each other. And then what we've done is we've looked at the light, and the light is consistent with what we would expect if there was a bunch of gold and platinum made in this collision.
But what do you mean made, though? Like, do you literally mean there's goblets of gold flying through space right now as a result of this?
Yeah.
Really? So I mean, there's...
What the explosion does is it synthesizes. You start with a bunch of neutrons. The star itself is, we call it a neutron star because it's essentially just a bunch of neutrons. But then when you rip those apart, the neutrons start synthesizing and you end up, it's called nucleosynthesis, you end up with a bunch of elements. And you produce things including gold and platinum. And it's very hard to do that in any other way in the universe.
Oh, tell me about it. Okay, so then, but I mean, literally that we have gold on Earth means that one upon a time that happened and that stuff fell to Earth, or it was part of Earth's creation?
It was part of Earth's creation. So the idea here is this: one of these events, which we call a kilonova, it creates a lot of gold. In fact, the equivalent of, say, 10 Earths worth of gold. So a lot. This is a lot of gold. But it just spews it out. It's a huge explosion. It just spews it out and kind of pollutes the galaxy with the gold. And so we've had lots of these over the history of the universe.
Yeah.
And so our galaxy has been, you know, quote, polluted. It's just full of this gold. And then when the Earth formed, some of the gold was hanging around and it fell and became part of the
Earth. Into the orbit and contributed into the Earth. Okay, so now, here's the thing that's kind of scary. They say that this burst that we witnessed had gamma rays. The gamma rays, intensely enough and focused appropriately enough, could wipe out life on Earth. Is that true? How close did this come to harming us? And what are the chances that, in fact, that will happen to us? Doc, We're talking about these neutron stars that collided with Daniel Holtz. He's a professor at the University of Chicago. And, Doc, before we just took that quick break, I asked you about the gamma rays. What are those, and are those dangerous, and did we just miss a bullet here?
So I've been furiously scribbling away during the ad break, and I just calculated that it should be one roughly every 100 million years might go off in our galaxy.
One of those neutron stars?
One of these neutron star collisions that will generate the gamma rays.
Oh, so we're cool.
I think we're okay, and most of them won't point our way anyway, because the gamma rays are emitted in a very narrow beam.
Okay.
So I think we're safe.
I thought I heard somewhere that, like, boy, good thing that thing didn't hit us or wipe us out, that it could have zapped us. Not so much, huh?
Not so much. We barely detected it with our gamma ray telescopes.
Your favorite space movie, and you do get to say Gravity, starring George Clooney and Sandra Bullock. I won't judge.
I loved Gravity. I took my class to see it. That was a great movie.
Well, then there it is. Do you have another movie you would recommend?
Well, I also really enjoyed Interstellar. I also took my
class. That's on my list. I just had that written down.
Oh, great. There you go. Yeah, that's a great movie. And it was Kip Thorne, who just won the Nobel Prize, was one of the people involved in writing the screenplay for that, and worked very hard to try to keep it scientifically accurate, but, kind
interesting
of being
still.
Free. Yeah, keeping an open mind about the possibilities.
Okay, the next time you're on, and there will be a next time, let's talk movies, okay?
Perfect. I would love to.
And we'll talk other science, too. Doctor, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Rokan is in the studio along with an enormous chicken salad sandwich.
It's actually turkey.
Turkey salad sandwich.
It's from the Starbucks. And wow. I would like to point out something.
That's how hungry you were today.
Starbucks changed their turkey sandwich. They moved it. It used to be like two halves clumped together, and it was like a little, almost like the size of a small softball. Bigger than baseball, smarter than softball. Mm-hmm. Anyway, now it's one flat sandwich, and they made it. And it was delicious in the beginning. It was like the bread was great. It was big. I'm like, wow, they made a change. And now incrementally, they're making it smaller and more processy.
Yeah.
And I would like to talk to Howard Schultz. I have a lot to talk to Howard Schultz about, because I checked what I do in a month there.
This is what you got to do today, Jason.
$130,000 a month in Starbucks.
Oh, you are. Probably keeping them afloat.
I am the what Elton John is to flowers, I am to Starbucks.
Who's your guest here you have with you today, fella?
I don't know. This is a guy that I'm told also works at WGN.
That's
never met him, even though he comes on afterwards.
He interviewed David Eggers last night.
I did, yeah.
Yes, Justin Coffin's going to be with us today.
Big fan of yours, Ro.
Thank you.
Big fan.
Thank you very much.
I agree with everything that you say, and I just want to let you know today it'll be a lot of yes and.
At 301.
To everything you say. I'm like, that Starbucks? Yeah. Starbucks sandwich, gross.
Am I right? Starbucks, am I right?
Ro's right.
Yeah.
Wow.
There you go. See? That's what we're going to do.
That's what we're going to do.
I see a bright future for you, young man.
Now, listen, I want to tell you a few things coming up. A.B. Stoddard's going to be on with us to talk about what's – and we're going to also explain what just happened with healthcare, because it's confusing. There's been a bipartisan agreement now.
Yeah, how about that?
The president, this whole negotiating thing that the president does, goes, I'm blowing it all up. And then next thing you know, they go, all right, we'll do a bipartisan thing. That worked. I don't think Kim Jong-un is going to have the same reaction. Well, okay, a separate issue. But AB will explain that. We'll also explain what happened. Grant DePorter. Have you ever heard of him? He's from Harry Caray's in Chicago.
Oh, really?
He doesn't get any press, but he's going to be here. Have you heard this magic number, 113? You remember 108 last year? He says the Cubs' magic number this year is 113. He's got 113 reasons why it's 113, and they're actually kind of spooky.
Oh, no kidding. Like 113 is the total number of things, or the number of this guy and all that?
Exactly.
Really, 113 is our sort of synchronicity number this year.
That's what he says. And
give me an example. Do you have one?
Yes. That Joe Madden hoisted the World Series trophy at 1:13 in the afternoon on 11/3.
Okay, but how does that help us win tonight's
game?
Doesn't
worry. I don't know. We'll ask him. And listen to this.
All I need is a win tonight.
Eddie Olczyk will join us.
Awesome.
Let's talk about an amazing story. Eddie Olczyk will be here at 4:40 today to talk about his battle against colon cancer and his return to the broadcast booth, at least temporarily.
Cool, man.
That's at 4:40 today. So all of that coming your way.
And I was told there'd be no math.
Yeah.
Oh, wait till you hear this math. I have a story about how this really impacted me in a very negative way.
113?
Yes. Yeah, I'll tell you about it.
All right.